from the Harvard Kennedy School and the University of Cambridge, welcome to a special collaborative episode of Justice Matters and Declarations, the Human Rights Podcast. We've joined forces here in Washington, D.C., at a conference hosted by the Harvard Kennedy School's Carr Center for Human Rights Policy, George Washington University, and the World Bank.
The Contentious Narratives Conference focuses on how disinformation, the spread of lies, the suppression of truth, disrupts our ability to document human rights abuses and ultimately acts as a barrier towards creating a stable, secure world.
Do we live in a post-truth world? How does information shape national and international politics? Can we fact-check reliably in the social media age, and can we imagine a future where those sorts of standards can be enforced online? These are just some of the questions we'll be grappling with together today.
To examine these questions and others about the ever-shifting media landscape, today we're joined by Malachy Brown, a senior story producer of the New York Times. Malachy has led investigations from Yemen to the refugee camp known as the Calais Jungle. He's a leader in using open-source digital techniques to verify social media stories, work that gets right to the heart of today's episode. My name is Sushma Raman. I'm the executive director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy.
I'm Matt Mahmoudi, a PhD candidate at the Center of Development Studies at the University of Cambridge.
And I'm Max Curtis, also from Cambridge and a researcher at the Center for European Policy Analysis here. And welcome to a special episode of Justice Matters and Declarations.
I'm Malachy Brown. I'm a senior story producer at the New York Times, and I specialize in visual investigations and open source reporting. And what that means is, you know, drawing evidence and facts from disparate sources of information, from social media, from satellite imagery, from cell phone videos, and extracting information that allows us to answer questions around events in far-flung places and near places.
Thank you for joining us today, Malachy.
Thanks for having me.
Given that you're using multiple sources of information, including social media and other information on the internet, is there a way to responsibly report news? And what are the implications for truth when readers are increasingly getting their news from different sources?
So we live in an era where there's more information than ever, and that information is accessible to the public. There's also more disinformation than ever, and so truth can be manipulated, and lies and falsehoods can be spread, and very quickly. You know, when I think about information, I'm thinking about that as evidence. All of these multiple disparate sources of information are essentially evidence to answer basic journalistic questions like who, what, where, why, when, how an event happened. And essentially we're thinking of creative ways to bring more evidence into our reporting doing this type of open source investigative work. And, you know, that helps us get to the truth of a matter. It gives us more information to establish timelines and facts independent of traditional sources and, you know, official authorities and official accounts of an event. And, you know, that's essentially what journalism and human rights investigation is. And so I think these types of techniques should be embraced and actually, you know, spread through newsrooms and through journalism courses and human rights groups. And it should become traditional. Traditionally, open source investigation drew on any publicly available source of information, and that could be a news article, it could be an official report, it could be World Bank data, it could be any of the above. In recent times, because of the accessibility of satellite data and imagery and the explosion in content and information being shared in social networks, you know, it has almost by default tended to mean that, including that as part of the investigative techniques. And so the type of journalism I do relies heavily on that, but also combines traditional reporting and other types of reporting. I mean, traditionally it was referred to as open source intelligence that would pull from multiple sources, be it media articles that are already published and government records and all sorts of different data, including satellite imagery. But now there's so much visual content available, particularly through social media networks. You know, that's the area that we've specialized in. And for us, it has come to represent a focus on that, because there is so much discernible information embedded within images, you know, from the metadata around when it was created, who first posted it onto social platforms, what the images themselves show. And so every pixel of an image really kind of contains evidence.
And with the use of social media, given that it is in a supposedly democratic space, more individuals and publics can start engaging with news outlets as well as human rights fact finders in delivering evidence. But I'm also wondering about the caveats of that and the sort of implications this has for countries like Russia and the United States and some of the larger issues that we've been talking about during this conference today.
I mean, the public certainly can participate. And, you know, a few years ago, I was involved in a group called Reportedly. And what that was kind of real time, iteratively figuring out situations and events as they were breaking and creating a community almost around a certain event, identifying people who are more familiar with a particular story or situation, you know, be that in Burundi or Yemen or usually these things are most valuable in places that are more difficult to access by traditional journalists and investigators in capturing evidence early after an event. So, I mean, there's great potential in that. And there's also great potential in the community, in the crowd, fact-checking journalists and reports and providing new shreds of evidence. I found we did an investigation into the Las Vegas shooting last year, and that performed well on social media, and people were coming forward with new videos and emailing me in content, and so that gave us more context for us to follow up and do more reporting.
That's really interesting. I think I've seen some tweets from Elliot Higgins of Bellingcat putting out, you know, can somebody find the sign, or can somebody find, you know, whatever picture it is that he's put out there. And, you know, within a few minutes, the crowds of Twitter flocked to his account with an actual answer, which is really, really fascinating.
Yeah, it is. I mean, recently we had, you know, we were vetting a source, and without revealing any details of that person's identity, we put out a stamp from one page on the passport.
Walk us through a human rights investigation that you might have done where you have to come into a country that perhaps you don't know much about. There's a range of actors, state and non-state actors, and you have to figure out who to trust, what information sources you should rely on, how to verify them. Tell us a little bit about how you go about this and how long does this take?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my reporting is done from a distance, so it's using this ambient data and open source information. And so recently, for instance, we heard that, you know, there was a scorched earth policy happening in a place called Ituri province in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which was one of the most violent places in the mid-2000s, tens of thousands of people killed. And that was concerning. So immediately what we did was we looked for on NASA's active fire data database. They publicly update this database with active fires around the world, you know, every week. And so we could see fires burning. It's a large area, and so many of those could have been forest fires. And so what we did was we combined that with OpenStreetMap data to show populated areas. And that allowed us to narrow our searches into where fires in populated areas were happening and to order satellite imagery from there. And yes, we could see entire villages had been razed, you know. And then we started investigating it in greater detail, and we talked to humanitarian organizations who are on the ground and who are across the water from where this was happening in Uganda, and that's where they were receiving the first waves of these refugees. Then the violence spread inland, and you know, we're just figuring that out by monitoring workers on the ground through social media. There was a vacuum of social media from those populations. But, you know, as they were arriving in reception centers, we were talking to UNICEF, UNHCR, and then, you know, in-country experts who are monitoring the political situation there and relaying to us the stories that people were coming. They were very, you know, I think through a couple of decades of work there, they have established relationships with the elders in these various different ethnic groups and communities there. And so we were incorporating that information that they were getting from village elders, saying, we don't know what's behind this violence. We feel that there are outside factors motivating it. It's still unclear, but there is a political vacuum in that country. And so, you know, it's ripe for outside actors to try to stoke violence. So that's one example of us using experts' traditional reporting, but also very quickly using ambient data to identify where the violence is happening.
And you've used these kind of techniques in the context of the digital verification cores, which have been established in cooperation with Amnesty International, the kinds of work that they do in covering Syria, as well as the Congo and Honduras and Mexico and all sorts of other investigations that requires us to use social media data. And you've been quite active in sort of in mentoring and providing guidance on how to use these techniques. And I wonder if this is a little bit about how the average user and how our listeners might want to get involved with doing some open source investigative work themselves, and whether that's really the level of democratization that we're talking about here.
Yeah, I mean, many of the tools that we use are out there and available and free, and it's just a matter of knowing where to find them and then teaching yourself to use them. And through repetition, you understand, well, which tool will work in a certain scenario. And there are great case studies on firstdraftnews.com, theverificationhandbook.com, Bellingcat do excellent case studies as well. GIJC, the Global Investigative Journalism Conference, they have a list of tip sheets from many of the presenters that were there last November in South Africa, which is a really valuable resource. And what I encourage people to do is to create their own workstation on Google Chrome, or there's a great tool that we use called start.me. And that's just a dashboard where you can save bookmarks and tools, you know, download Chrome extensions, and you know, you can create a Chrome profile so that that is synced to the cloud. It doesn't contain any sensitive information about you, but what that means is that at any computer anywhere in the world, you can sit down and you have your workstation with you and all of your tools available to you. And so I have them organized around, like, these are the tools I use to interrogate Facebook or to search through Facebook. These are the ones for Twitter, for YouTube. And these are the mapping tools that I'll use, you know, Wikimapia, Bing Maps, Google Maps, and other ones, Yandex, that will give me information about places and place names.
It seems like in this age of information that's available instantly from a variety of sources, that places like the New York Times still have this onus on them, whether it's because of attacks on quote-unquote the liberal media in the U.S. or even around the world, where people perceive Western media as having a bias for certain agendas. So how do you do this work in a way that incorporates various sources of data but still maintain the public trust?
It's a challenge in this specific type of work because you're gathering so many disparate evidence points, and you want to have 3, 4, 5 corroborating points for every single factoid that you're going to use in an investigation. But that's way too much information and too dense to present to audiences. And so what we're trying to do is to, just as, you know, we use every pixel on a screen to gather evidence from, we are also using every inch of a screen to present that information back to people and to carry them through and to show them rather than tell them what they're seeing, and almost to have that educational element to it, and really just being about transparent about our reporting processes and the evidence that we've gathered, and here's why this evidence is leading us to a particular conclusion. Or, you know, it's not that we are concluding, but this is what the volume of evidence that we've gathered suggests is a plausible explanation for something that has happened. We often do that. And it's really about, I find with the visual, you know, the visual evidence in particular is conducive to showing and not telling people. And so, you know, then the penny drops with people and they can come to their own conclusions. You know, I'm talking here about reporting on a specific event. Of course, there are other perhaps valid criticisms of news organizations in the types of coverage that they do and sort of the coverage that they ignore as well. That's a different argument. But I find with this type of stuff, people really engage with it. And, you know, one thing that we measure is, you know, how long people watch videos. And in this sort of attention deficit economy, it's a difficult thing to carry people through. But people really engage with this type of evidence-based reporting.
To Sushma's point about trust and everything you're saying about building that trust with your audience, could you walk us through some of what you did in video forensics, I think as you call it, during the Las Vegas shooting? And what were you thinking, or how did you find the engagement afterwards? Because it was such a popular story.
Mm-hmm. you know, the genesis of that story were the gaps in the official timeline, the gaps in the official account of what happened on that day. And there were shifting timelines. And so we wanted to establish an independent timeline using, you know, the many different social media videos and camera phone videos that we saw people sharing of that awful night. And so the first thing was to cast the net as wide as possible across multiple social networks, gather up as many videos as possible of that night. I think we gathered around 45 and about 35 of the shooting itself. And by watching all of those, awful as they were, they did give us bits and pieces of evidence, such as the duration of a burst of gunfire, the interval to the next one. And by documenting those patterns in the videos, we were able to recreate the entire 10 minutes of that shooting, plus 5 or 6 minutes either side of it, and then overlay police scanner audio and EMT audio as well to be able to see minute by minute what was happening over at the hotel, in the fairgrounds, on Las Vegas Boulevard where the police responded, you know, over on Giles Street at the far end of the venue where people were fleeing. It gave us the ability to granularly look at how different people responded, basically.
How long did that take?
Took us about 3 weeks.
Yeah. Altimap, like 1 hour or so?
Altimap, 10 minutes, yeah. So we had to go through it in really fine detail, yeah, stitch it together. The production of that as well took a big part of that time, because we were using a 3D model to guide people through where different scenes were unfolding and what was happening at various different places. So it was very graphics heavy, and deciding amongst all of the information that we had gathered, what were the most important pieces to relay, and then how we were going to move from scene to scene. And we didn't really have characters to go through, so the locations became the characters. And so you would go back to these different locations different stages in the 11-minute video.
So that's much like the kinds of techniques that forensic architecture would use. Only, from what we know of the videos that they produce, some of those take like 4 months or so to reconstruct, right?
That's right, yeah. And doing things like, you know, you're hearing in the videos, you're hearing the bullets pass overhead before you hear the thud of the gun in the room. It takes longer for that sound to travel. And so 3 bullets will have passed, but then there's reverberation from bullets ricocheting, hitting the ground, hitting objects in the stadium. And so we also stretched the audio so that we could identify the bullets cracking through the air and do an accurate bullet count. And that gave us additional context as to what the gunman was doing, how many rounds he fired each time, and so on.
What gives you hope?
I was going to come out with an awfully cliched response there.
We've been talking about such gloomy, depressing acts of violence.
What gives me hope is that there's more information now that allows us to create accountability. And although in horrific situations like the Syrian conflict and the Yemen conflict, where there's an absolute failure of any international organization to be able to act, you know, in time, there hopefully will be justice through the evidence that has been gathered now by not just news organizations and human rights investigators, but, you know, groups like Bellingcat and the Syrian Archive and various different other groups.
I suppose one of the difficulties here is also that we're dealing with stuff in hindsight, right? We're not doing something that's necessarily preventative, for sure. Like, we can't know that. This is a measure that's always happening after the fact. And that's often why we talk about, at least within the context of the Digital Verification Corps, secondary trauma, the feeling of helplessness, that you can't do anything about the kinds of violations or violence that you're observing. And, you know, what are some of the techniques that you use yourself, and what are some of the difficulties in dealing with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, studies show that vicarious trauma happens when you're overexposed to violent images, and you do have that sense of, you know, helplessness and hopelessness around a situation that you are emotionally invested in, combined with workplace stress or other types of stresses. So I think it's a question of managing all of those things, the workload, expectations, and that sort of thing. And I think for managers, it's something for them particularly to be acutely aware of, because investigators themselves may not recognize the signs or be too invested in a story, you know, want to get to a conclusion. But there are times when managers need to check in with their staff. Are you okay? I'll reassign you for a short period of time and take breaks. And I think I've seen that actually very recently at one research organization where somebody is devoted full time, 5 days a week or longer, to investigating war crimes in Syria. And another person is 2 days a week, but 3 days a week working on very progressive and uplifting work in training citizens to become investigators effectively. And the difference between the two people was stark to me, you know. So I think it's there are some lessons definitely there.
Interesting. What gives everybody else hope?
I think seeing the enthusiasm of young people from around the world who are trying to figure out ways in which to change not just their governments but also their societies and communities and values and so on. So it's very exciting.
Yeah, and you know, challenging officials. And yeah, I mean, it's democratic. It's kind of like the citizens' forum now.
Mm-hmm. Well, like last weekend, we saw the March for Our Lives in D.C. And I don't think that would have necessarily happened if we hadn't had so much, you know, social media video going out. Even as it was going on at the Parkland shooting, that's part of what galvanized the movement, I think, that you feel like you're in it, you have this engagement, and you feel like you can also reach out through social media. The fact that so many of these survivors are organizing via social media or even simply mocking actual people who aren't doing anything in Congress or what have you.
Yeah. What struck me about those survivors is how savvy they are in using the platforms. I mean, that's been striking, that and how quick they are to, you know, ridicule people who are challenging them on various different media outlets.
Yeah, people who are actually born in social media, essentially.
Yeah. I suppose one of the things that worries me when it comes to the broader question of contentious narratives that we're dealing with here vis-a-vis social media is also how some of these allegiances are also already algorithmically set. The question of fact and fiction may not ultimately matter as much when you're dragged into, based on how you browse and based on what kind of groups you follow and so on, you're dragged into certain echo chambers or, you know, certain groups that you're suggested to join or pages to like or advertisements to click. And so, like, it's almost like your allegiances are predetermined somewhat. And does that not conflict a little bit with sort of the kind of optimism that we're trying to build up?
Yes, but I think there's far greater awareness of that now. People can go out and find independent sources of information themselves. But I think you're right. I think there's probably a case there for greater education and for news literacy to be part of the curriculum at a much earlier age for teenagers.
So to frame it one way, some people, for instance, talk about the fact that we're living in an age of information warfare. Do you think that, say, at the New York Times, you're, you know, soldiers on the front of that? And do you think, for instance, that the tools that you're using are maybe the new weapons in that fight? Or is that maybe pitting you against things like Sinclair Broadcasting in ways that are just not fair and not really comparable?
Yeah, it's a really tough one for me to answer.
That's the questions we like to ask.
Yeah, I think it's not really comparable to you know, sort of as a citizen, what you're seeing with mass media conglomerates is concerning. But in terms of, you know, comparing what the reporting that we do and the reporting that they do, I don't think it is comparable. I think, you know, they do good local reporting when it counts. And I think the risk is that, you know, if there's mass messaging, as was indicated recently with a group like that, to a large segment of the population, then that is definitely concerning.
Yes, before we conclude this episode, I'd be interested in hearing what is a typical day in the life of Malachy Brown?
A typical life, or a typical day, I don't think there is any typical day. Very often looking outside the news for leads and ideas. It is taking those leads and ideas also from a network of people who are contacting us with information about projects that they're working on as well. prospecting those and seeing if there's a story in it or something that we can bring that's additive or that reveals something new about a situation, and then managing those productions with a team of reporters and visual artists, basically.
Thank you for joining us for this special episode. If you like what you're hearing, do check out Justice Matters on iTunes, Google Play, and find us on the web at simplecast.com.
And follow Declarations Back Across the Pond on iTunes, SoundCloud, Anchor.fm, really wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Declarations Pod for all the latest episodes.
Thanks for tuning in, and see you next time.